Professor Madsen, period. Through a rather arbitrary process that I won't bother to bore you with, Professor Manning will be our lead speaker, followed by Dr. Peery and John Ryan wrapping it all up. Our first speaker is an old friend of the Philadelphia Society, a longtime trustee, our senior vice president, a professor of law at the University of Miami and director of its Center for Law and Economics, formerly on the faculty of the University of Rochester, George Washington University, and received his advanced degrees at the University of Chicago and at Yale. He comes particularly well qualified to participate in this panel tonight, not just because he's been at odds, shall we say, with the SEC for many years, or written very widely on different regulatory agencies, but because he's just had a two-week experience that everybody in this room should be exposed to at least once. He has been confined in a very luxurious resort hotel with 20 senior congressional staffers, ranging from one or two right-wingers to a couple from Bill Proxmire's staff, one from Claiborne Pell's staff, and six from the Library of Congress. And second prize would be, I guess, 4 weeks. So Professor Manning comes to us as both a distinguished academician and also, in effect now, a practicing politician. Henry?
I decline the introduction. I don't know about you, but I'm beginning to feel that I couldn't come to one of these meetings without having something to say. I feel a little bit in this case like as Fritz Hayek described his sensations to us this morning when he arrived in New York in 1945 and was told that he was to address a large number of people on a topic that he had not previously addressed himself to. I was under the impression that my function tonight was to comment on a speech that was to be given by Ed Fulmer. And I'm quite certain that I was led to that impression by Ed Fulmer.
But you can't complain too loudly because I'm the one who reimburses the expense, right?
Since the subject is, in a sense, bureaucracy, however, I suppose we can't really anticipate honesty anyway. We'll put that behind us. Now, I warn you that, consistent with Professor Hayek's experience of some years ago, that when invited to make a few remarks, it's much easier to do if one knows in advance. And if I address myself to an audience before a podium and you see me walk up with a thick stack of yellow pages, you know that I will stay within the confines of the time period allotted, which is normally 20 minutes or something of that sort. But when I come with a half a page of notes written on a quarter of a piece of paper, that were a schedule of events, May 8th of which says Governor Ronald Reagan dinner announcement, you know that you're in for a long talk. It takes a long time to prepare a short talk. I want to address myself, however, to a subject that comes with some ease, other people's work. As I think that great philosopher Tom Lehrer once said, plagiarized. Well, that's not exactly what I'm going to do, because there is a respectable academic tradition of summarizing the literature in the field. And that's what I thought I would do for you tonight. Because oddly enough, there is a very, well, for the most part, quite new and I find quite exciting, intellectually stimulating and respectable literature developing in what might be called the economics of bureaucracy. There's one theory that's actually been around for a long time. There was a book written, I'm sorry, I don't recall the author's name at the moment, sometime in the 1920s or early 1930s, A History of the Interstate Commerce Commission, which, as we all know, is the first of the great federal commissions. There had been state predecessors, but nothing quite like the Interstate Commerce Commission, with its very peculiar history, political history of interrelationships with the populist farmers in the Midwest, the campaign against the Eastern banking monopolists, and the whole rigmarole of propaganda that went into that. But there was, as I say, starting quite early, a literature that expressed concern that the Interstate Commerce Commission was not doing the job that it was really established for, that is, to prevent restricted entry industries, railroads, from charging higher prices than would be true if entry were open to all competitors. And the theory developed that if you have an agency that is designed to regulate an industry, that in short order the industry captures the agency. It does this in a variety of ways. It does this, first of all, there's a political version of the argument that states that after the initial hubbub and excitement of having an agency to regulate the evils, sons of so-and-sos, that no one watches anymore, and consequently the lobbyists for the regulated industry become the only interested group who have any contact with the congressional committees that either appropriate funds or control the substantive authority of the agency. That was, I think that was substantially the principal version of the argument that was offered early. Later on, in fact quite recently, a strange bedfellow arrangement has developed. One finds the names of no less than Ralph Nader and Milton Friedman, often paired side by side in offering what I must say I think now think is a somewhat naive theory of what really happens that gives this, I don't want to say illusion because it's not completely an illusion, but almost, this feeling that the agencies don't do what the regulators thought they were designed for when they started, and that indeed they're doing more harm than good. The naive theory says that the reason the regulators behave as they do is that the industry needs some device to protect itself against competition and against entry into the industry. The agency can serve that purpose. But what incentive would the agency have to behave that way? Well, a number of things. Travel to exotic places, women who do exotic dances, jobs when they complete their work with the agencies, out-and-out bribes if you want to be crude, any number of ways in which the industry can pay off the regulators to keep the regulators hewing to the line of protecting the industry from competition. Now that's a naive theory and not necessarily an erroneous theory. It's naive because it's not sufficient, nor even is it a necessary theory. The reason that it's not a sufficient theory is that too much goes on, and I'm addressing myself particularly now to the major federal agencies, and I guess I'm addressing myself particularly, although not totally, to those like the ICC, the Federal Power Commission, Federal Communications Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, that largely deal with one industry. The trouble with the theory is that too often we find those agencies doing things that the industry loses by. That is, things that cost the industry considerable welfare, make their stock decline, make them spend additional money for safety apparatus, for all manner of things that the industry doesn't want to do, that goes beyond any simple explanation of merely raising entry costs as a barrier to competition. Well, a few years ago, a group of friends of ours, as a matter of fact, one who spoke here, I think 2 years ago, Bill Niskanen, now at Berkeley and shortly to become chief economist at the Ford Motor Company, addressed himself to this issue and has written perhaps the single most important book, and you'll have to pardon me, it has an odd title, but it's something like The Economic Theory of Bureaucracy, something of that sort, or Bureaucracy and Democratic...
Bureaucracy and Representative Government.
And Representative Government. Thank you, Gary. Niskanen said that our existing theories weren't sufficient. Incidentally, I should add that something else had happened in the interim. In the interim, a variety of the so-called New Left historians, led in this case by a man named Gabriel Kalko, but followed by another, frankly, more scholarly kind of writer, a man named William Hawley, had written works in which they, in effect, proved the naive theory. They showed that not only were these agencies operating to avoid and prevent competition and protect the industry from competition, but that the industries had, in fact, been at the forefront of the development of these agencies in the first place. There had been suspicions of that in various places, but these works seem to confirm it. Now, Kalko's work in particular got the greatest press and, as so often happens, had the greatest number of errors in it. Hawley's work, much less well-known, but a much, much more serious work of scholarship, is entitled The New Deal and the Problem of Monopoly. It's a history both of the NRA and of each of the major agencies created during the New Deal period and how it came about that certain industries were able to successfully press for this protection from competition, whereas other industries that had been covered by NRA codes prior to its being declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court did not succeed in getting an agency to regulate, for instance, the chicken plucker industry. If you remember, that was the industry involved in the case that declared the NRA unconstitutional, the Schechter case. Well, a few years ago, friends of ours who have the strange notion that I share with them that economics can explain more about behavioral motivation and activities than psychology or psychiatry, began looking into the issue of the behavior of individuals in the bureaucratic system. Now, the earliest works here, a very odd coincidence, were done totally independently, reached quite similar conclusions by two individuals, one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast, repeating thereby an identical coincidence that had occurred in another field of application of economic theory to politics some 15 years earlier. The two people were Anthony Downs and Gordon Tullock. Each of them, within the space of a year, came out with books, something like An Economic Theory of Bureaucracy. One of the two books, at least, must have that name. At any rate, their investigation was into a very special, and it was really a too advanced question, and that was, why is it that the top bureaucrats do such a bad job of doing whatever it is they set out to do, whether we like it or not, but by their own characterization of what they want, they don't succeed? And both of them gave fundamentally a similar response to that. And the response that is just so convincing that it's become sort of accepted lore, not merely in theory of bureaucracy, but in theory or organization theory generally, was that the problem was largely one of information flows, that it was impossible to get information, even of the sort needed for political decision making, from the broad base staff of a bureaucracy up to the peak of the pyramid, so that the ultimate decision maker could make a decision that really responded to the reality below. Some of you may recognize this theory is not unlike, not terribly unlike, even some of the ideas of Ludwig von Mises in explaining one of the many reasons why economic planning could never succeed. That is, you could never get accurate information on which to base decisions. What Downs and Tullock independently arrived at was the fact that this constant disruption and distortion of information as it moved up the hierarchy would necessarily leave the decision maker with erroneous information. Now, I say that was ahead of the times. We're just about to the point where we can use that kind of study today. Bill Niskanen was the one who really originated, I think, something that we can call an economic theory of bureaucracy. Bill looked to the question, really a dual question, in economic terms, what is the production function of an agency? That is, how is a decision made? What sort of model can we establish for what they do, what they produce, how much of it they'll produce, why they'll produce that rather than something else, and so forth? And as a corollary to that, he examined the question, what constitutes the demand for the product of a bureau or agency? Doing Bill a considerable injustice, I will summarize in just a few words. But basically, his notion was, as he looked around from both his own experience in Washington and from a theoretical perspective, and he said, quite clearly, there is one constituency that every top bureaucrat must respond to, and that's the one that determines the budget for the agency. Consequently, we would expect that whoever is responsible for paying the money is really the consumer, and that if the market works, and we think it does in politics and organizations as well as in more conventional types of markets, we would expect the top decision makers to respond to the incentive offered by the providers of the funds. There were a number of interesting corollaries he proved hypothesize as a result of this that comported very strongly with the theory, with facts as we know them, such as no successful bureaucrat ever spends less than the full amount allotted to him. It was, you see, You weren't supposed to laugh then. That's a serious point, and it was established in a quite rigorous fashion that seems to hold up quite well. I might add that it holds true of directors of centers and presidents of universities who get money from foundations and the government as well, that you must never have any money left over at the end of the year. You must always need more money the next year, for exactly the same reason that Niskanen offered in his book. Now, again, we had another piece in the puzzle fitting together. We had some explanation of some of the behavior. There were two constituencies now that we see involved in the picture. One is the industry, because the industry does play an important role in lobbying for and making contributions to the congressional committees that are relevant to the agency. And the other is the politician himself, who has some interest for some reason in either creating a stick that he can beat people in the head with, or an agency that passes out benefits and that he has some control over, so that no matter what it may cost the public, he maximizes his own political utilitarian position. There were still problems, however. We still couldn't explain what it was that led agencies to behave contrary to all of these notions. Why it was that the SEC, occasionally, well, very often the Federal Trade Commission, though that was, it gets a little more complicated because it cuts across industry line, Federal Communications Commission, Federal Power Commission, why they would behave in a way that clearly, severely injured the industry, regardless of any theory of whether they were protecting the public or anything else, that there were cases in which their behavior was of a sort that couldn't seem really to conform, certainly to the naive theory of industry control of the agency, and even the Niskanen-generated version of the agency as responding to the demand as created by congressional appropriations committees. And so I offer you the Manny theory. I don't think it is the last piece in the jigsaw puzzle. I think we're dealing with an incredibly complex system here. Incidentally, some of these ideas you can find again in von Mises in his great works on bureaucracy and on socialism, but there's a peculiar American accent to the nature of the arrangements that exist between industry, Congress, and the agencies in this country. Before I can advance you the Manny theory, if I may give it a nice-sounding name, one that has a pleasant ring to it, I think. I need a little bit of background. When the question of administrative law became, as Tocqueville said, every major issue in America does, a legal issue that ultimately got to the Supreme Court, the legal justification offered for the constitutionality of the delegation of legislative power that the Constitution said belonged exclusively to Congress was that experts would be needed in these areas because Congress could not be expected to do the day-to-day management of regulation of industries. Notice that there's an assumption there that the regulation was necessary. Congress was unable to do it, and therefore experts would have to be retained to perform that function. As the cases developed in that area in the late 1930s, and here I would say was one of the most unfortunate episodes in all of American jurisprudence, our courts, in one of the great shows of gutlessness, probably in their history, decided that they weren't about to get enmeshed in questions of whether rate-making agencies and allocational agencies and other regulatory agencies really knew what they were doing or not. And so they did what, as the modern slang would have, they copped out. And they copped out by coming to the conclusion that if the agency gave sufficient notice to everyone involved and held a hearing, put quotation marks around the word hearing because it's a technical term of art for lawyers. No one else would ever give it the definition that lawyers and the courts have. If they held these things, that is, if the procedural requirements were complied with, the courts would then assume the expertise of the agency. But the effect of that was the agencies could be totally irresponsible. They could do absolutely anything they wanted to, just so long as they gave notice that they were going to hold a hearing and they convened in a room. My favorite story of this is the single rule that today governs 90% of the law in the field of securities regulation in this country was adopted in 1942. It was drafted in one afternoon, or over an evening, by a branch lawyer of the SEC in Philadelphia, took the train into Washington the following morning to deal with a very specialized problem they had, and nothing else. This is, for those of you in the know, it's the famous or infamous Rule 10b-5. It said that thou shalt do no evil, in effect. There's not another word in it more specific than what I said. The total expertise, and this is in the record, was one statement by one member of the SEC who said, "Well, I guess we are against fraud, aren't we?" That's the total oral record of the hearing held on Rule 10b-5. Under Rule 10b-5 today, all trading in securities by insiders has been made illegal. Almost anything you do in mergers, in takeovers, in a whole list of things is now covered by that rule as interpreted by the SEC. The point of this is there really wasn't any expertise. We never did have experts. That's not to say that there aren't some decent bacteriologists at the Food and Drug Administration, and I suppose there's still some people around the ICC who know what a steam boiler on a locomotive does. I'm not sure they have any diesel specialists at all. But the point of this is that it became very clear that expertise had nothing to do with the regulation that we were involved with at all. That something totally different was involved. Now, Niskanen's theory, that again is a sufficient theory, says it was simply a circle. Congress appropriated money. People in the agencies wanted to build themselves up politically. Consequently, they always wanted to spend that money and justify more employees and a higher budget the following year. The congressional people had some interest in purchasing the power over industry that they could wield via the bureaucracy, and the whole thing would move in that direction. Nonetheless, none of this would explain why, or give us the theory that would explain why the agencies would sometimes injure the industries they were regulating. are another very peculiar phenomenon that has been noticed. And that is that industry officials will never be heard complaining about regulation. Now, this is a very strange phenomenon. I call it to your attention to see if it tests out empirically with your own casual observation. Not long ago, well, I'm sure many of you know that within the last 3 weeks, the Rock Island Railroad, the Rock Island Line, it was a mighty fine line, went bankrupt. It had for some 12 years been the woo-wee, if I may coin a word, of aborted marriages. Two railroads at least in financially stronger position sought to take over the Rock Island, but through various machinations of one sort and another, those mergers never went through. I won't in any sense try and go through the incredibly complex legal history of that event. But if you stop to think about it, the ICC was clearly blocking that merger either into the Northwestern Railroad, Chicago Northwestern, or the Union Pacific. Why? Who were they helping and who were they hurting? Well, you think about it, it's really very peculiar. Certainly they weren't helping the railroad industry. Certainly they weren't helping the shareholders of the Rock Island. And certainly they weren't helping the shareholders of either of the other two railroads that at one time or another presented very, very attractive offers for the shares of the Rock Island. Who could have wanted to stave off that takeover? Same people that want to stave off every takeover, the managers of the Rock Island Railroad. Now is the Manny theory. The reason that it was a Manny theory is because it happened to fit with something I had written many years ago, and I don't like to let old ideas sit around unused, and if I could use an old idea in a new place, I would, and here was a good chance to do it. Because I had developed a theory some time ago that there is a peculiar market that I called in an article in the Journal of Political Economy, a market for corporate control that functions just like any other market. Individuals who believe that they can, that assets in their hands will be worth more than they are in the hands of the present holders, will offer enough to have a voluntary exchange and all the mutual benefits that go with voluntary exchange. That's a competitive model of the market for corporate control. But remember that anyone presently in control never wants that to happen. No one wants competition for his own position. Competition's for everybody else, not for yourself. And so, the flash bulb went on over my head, and I began to realize something. That over the years, as I have had occasion from time to time to look into the legislation in many, many areas of industry regulation, railroads, trucking, banking, insurance, shipping, broadcasting stations, it's not true of oil companies as far as I know, but I'm not positive, number of others, any of the ones that we would call public utilities, the traditionally regulated industries, there is inevitably a provision that either explicitly or implicitly says you may not change control of this company without the permission of the agency. Aha, I said. Now I think I understand something. Now I think I understand why we have this illusion to some extent, although there is some truth to it as well, that the agency is always in bed with the industry, so to speak. That the agency always seems to be protecting the industry. It's not the industry they're protecting at all. The ones they're protecting are the individuals that have the most to lose from not having the kind of regulation that subtly operates every time you regulate an industry. What you do is raise barriers to entry into the market for control of companies in the regulated business. Now, actually, this is much more complicated than I'm suggesting here. There are a variety of ways in which substantive regulation raises the costs by lowering the possible payoff of taking over regulated firms. As a result, what we would expect is that the leaders of industries that are regulated would like it very much. Those on the outside, since we can't even identify them, can never be spokesmen for an opposite point of view, other than a rare case like the Rock Island situation, where they didn't dare antagonize the ICC anyway because they had to deal with them regularly on all manner of other activities. I like this theory because it's a theory that relates to individual behavior and individual motivation. The naive theory had too much collectivist methodology, if you will. I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but really in the methodological sense. It collectivized industry and said industry has an interest. Well, what we find is that individuals within a given industry can have quite opposing interests. That the leader of one brokerage firm may very well have quite competing interests with the president of another brokerage or underwriting house. And yet, there's no way in the world that one can affect the other in a very significant control fashion without the full approval of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and that may or may not be forthcoming. Well, what can we do if this is the problem? Since, in a sense, what all of this is all about is to A, see if a problem exists, B, try and diagnose it correctly, and three, if we diagnose it correctly, prescribe the correct cure. Well, one we know is very simple, abolish all the agencies. That one's too easy though, and I won't stop merely with that one. I would point out two things that I've really mentioned in passing, that there is some possibility of doing something about, and that indeed we happen to be possibly at one of those watersheds of legal history, literally today. For all I know, yesterday the legislation was adopted, when something is being done and in a number of places at once. Concept of deregulation has become a buzzword in Washington. Principal statute deregulating railroads, trucks, and airlines is being drafted in Ted Kennedy's office right now. I know that because I talked to the Harvard law professor who's on leave to be a visiting professor at the Kennedy Institute in Cambridge. I talked to him in Washington where he told me that he's really working in Ted Kennedy's office, and he told me that that's so. And since he was bragging about it, I have no reason to think in that case that he was lying. So there is, A, that possibility. B, another that, they say, may have been already passed, and I haven't heard about it, but we're very optimistic, may shortly be adopted in Florida. And if it's adopted in a number of other states, it would then have considerable possibility of being adopted nationally. And that's legislation that will require every agency to prove that it knows what it's doing. That's a giant step that courts wouldn't take, and so the legislatures would have to. We're going to try and do this by a bill that would require every agency to justify every order on a cost-benefit basis comparing the regulatory system to a pure non-regulated system. Well, I hope you're all laughing and applauding when you read in the paper in a week or so that this has been passed. It has a very strong possibility of adoption in Florida. At least 17 other states have expressed serious interest in this legislation. The final one, though, if that legislation begins to move ahead, and incidentally, we put the burden in that statute that was drafted at our center, Center for Studies in Law and Economics, the University of Miami, we put, somebody has to make the final decision on those things. We put it back to the courts. Now, believe me, we did that with considerable trepidation. We think there might be a judge in Florida whom, with sufficient expert witnesses giving him a basic course in economics, we can explain what the statute says. And hopefully, we can be in control enough of the first litigation that we can provide a precedent that other judges, who will never in a million years understand it, but they'll follow it. And hopefully courts in other states will as well. More importantly than that, if that legislation begins to be successful in any extent, courts will begin to do this on their own, as they should have 40 years ago or 50 years ago anyway. But at that point, it was just too easy to say, it's not our responsibility, we'll leave it to the agencies to do themselves. Well, I warned you that it was going to be long because I didn't have long to prepare. I've reviewed the literature and even one article that hasn't been published as yet. Thank you.